Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Judge Hamilton, who is appearing remotely. We have one case for argument this afternoon, 25-1460, Atrum v. Hoy. Ms. Nichols, whenever you're ready. Good afternoon. Before you begin, Judge Hamilton, can you hear us okay?
Just fine, thanks.
May it please the court. Wisconsin imposes lifetime GPS monitoring on people who are no longer under supervision without any individualized review and without any mechanism for determining whether continued monitoring remains justified until 2 decades later. The district court upheld that regime by treating Bolo as dispositive rather than engaging in the fact-sensitive inquiry the Fourth Amendment demands. As a result, the district court failed to consider the breadth and heterogeneity of the population this statute applies to, the proof of substantial privacy and dignitary harms that the statute imposes, or the lack of evidence that long-term monitoring of this particular population meaningfully advances the state's interests. No one denies the seriousness of sexual offending or the state's strong interest in combating it, but the Fourth Amendment does not ask whether a search feels intuitively justified. It asks whether, in light of the evidence, the state has put forth a constitutionally sufficient justification for the search.
Ms. Nichols, do you think the legislature could impose a mandatory consent to a home search provision, for example, and for somebody on parole or probation?
I think that's exactly what the Supreme Court upheld, Your Honor, in Sampson or Knights. There are cases where individuals have been required as a condition of parole or probation or some other form of government supervision to consent to searches, yes.
Right, right. And without individualized analysis being required, correct?
Correct.
So why is this different? I mean, there have been a number of cases that have dealt with various kinds of additional provisions that have been added on to registered sexual offenders, for example, who had completed their criminal sentence before the legislation was enacted. But as I understand it, Mr. Antrim committed at least one of these crimes and was convicted after the legislation imposing this requirement. Is that correct?
Your Honor, Mr. Antrim's convictions were in 1991 and 1998. He, at this point, has been off of any form of government supervision since 2018. He has been out of prison for 14 years now. And so what I think categorical restrictions such as registration have been upheld. Post-conviction, no supervision. But I think that you can't necessarily port over the categorical justification for something like a registration scheme to something so much more intrusive and long-lasting for someone who's not under supervision when we're putting a monitor.
That sort of begs the question, is my concern about no longer under supervision given this legislation. And I don't understand you to be making any ex post facto argument here, are you?
No, that is not the constitutional claim in this case.
Okay. Well, given the obvious question, at least it seems to me, is given that Wisconsin could enact much more severe prison sentences for these crimes, what's wrong with, in essence, probation or parole light in the form of GPS monitoring without the more aggressive supervision that we would expect for somebody on parole?
Well, that's not what the state has done here. Mr. Antrim had criminal process and he was sentenced to a term of imprisonment and a term of post-imprisonment supervision in the community that he successfully completed. And at that point, the state's custody over him terminated. And now he is on a monitor approximately 14 years later with the state continuing to track his movements. So I think that his status within the criminal justice system does matter to the constitutionality of this restriction, the relationship between Mr. Antrim and the state, is something that is taken into account when determining whether a particular search is reasonable. So I don't...
Why are you not raising up an ex post facto problem?
Myriad of reasons, including this court's previous decisions that, in our judgment, seemed to show some hesitancy about the ex post facto claim. But here, Fourth Amendment reasonableness encompasses all of these aspects of the search, how long it is enduring, how intensive it is, how the relationship between Mr. Antrim and the state, which is no longer a supervisory relationship, the breadth and heterogeneity of the population that this statute applies to. And so I think where the district court really went wrong was acting as though the facts do not matter to the constitutional analysis under the Fourth Amendment.
I'm not sure that's a fair characterization of the district court's thinking. Could you address perhaps the Supreme Court's treatment in, I'll pronounce it Kebido, about dealing with conflicting and conflicting evidence and uncertainty about the effectiveness of these sorts of measures and on the frequency of actual recidivism for this population?
I think that in the context of a regime like registration, where an individual is being required to report information about their residence and other demographic information about themselves on a regular basis, categorical regimes have been upheld, and the government is allowed to proceed by presumption, essentially. But as we move along this continuum towards restrictions that are much more intense, much more intrusive, much more long-lasting, and affect constitutionally protected interests so much more strongly, the same categorical justification can't be invoked.
Didn't we reject that argument in our affirmance of the preliminary injunction that this was so much more onerous than the registration requirements?
So I think that there was a preliminary injunction, and you found that on the record that was before the court at that time, Mr. Antrim and the proposed class that he represented at that time weren't entitled to preliminary injunctive relief. The case was sent back down, and a factual...
Because of a likelihood of success, but yes. One of the issues we did address was your argument at that point about the registration requirements being this GPS monitoring being so much more onerous than registration, and we rejected that argument. So I don't see the facts differentiating that.
So obviously under the Fourth Amendment's reasonableness test, the facts matter greatly, and we learned a lot in discovery. One presumption that was imported from Bolo into this court's Bram decision was that it's minimally intrusive. And we learned in discovery by taking depositions of Wisconsin Department of Corrections officials that it is much more intrusive than the court presumed in Bolo, because all GPS monitoring data is treated as a public record subject to disclosure to anyone for any reason forever. This data is permanently maintained. It's given to any law enforcement agency that asks for it or any private citizen that asks for it under the open records law. So the intrusion into privacy is, I think, a lot more significant than the court assumed in Bolo and continued to assume at the preliminary injunction stage in this case.
But doesn't the evidence show that the registration requirements are also subject to public availability?
What you can learn from looking at the Wisconsin Sex Offender Registry is the nature of the person's conviction, their photograph, and their current residential address. That shows up on a website. What you can learn from GPS data is, as the court recognized in Carpenter and Jones, a precise time-correlated record of every place the person has gone, once a minute for at least 2 decades, if not much longer under this statute. So I just don't think it's possible to liken that kind of data about a person's associations, where they go, what they do, to simply putting on a website the person's conviction, demographic information, and where they reside. They're just a different type of intrusion, and that was not known at the time we were here on the preliminary injunction several years ago. We learned a lot in discovery. We learned a lot on both sides of this equation. Reasonableness under the Fourth Amendment requires a careful, fact-bound analysis of both those individual interests that are affected, but also of the government interests. And there was expert discovery in this case that showed this statute and the monitoring of this particular population that is subject to this statute is not really advancing the government interests as they put them forth. It's telling that the state of Wisconsin hired an expert who ought to testify to the usefulness of this monitoring, and that expert only identified examples of people who were still on probation or parole. One would assume that if this statute, which has been in effect for a long time now, was producing great results for the state, enabling them to catch recidivistic crime or investigate crimes effectively, they would have brought that evidence forward. But they didn't because it doesn't exist. And I think it's very important for the court.
Excuse me, but could I go back to something you were raising a moment ago about the public records problem? Suppose we were to disagree with you on the overall Fourth Amendment problem here, but thought that there's a problem with treating this sorts of information as public records. Is there a remedy that would be available to you or to your client or the class in this case that would address that problem? Or is that something that would need to be deferred to another case, a later case?
I think that it's part and parcel of the reasonableness analysis of whether this particular statute as applied to this particular population and as carried out by the Wisconsin Department of Corrections violates the plaintiffs and the class's Fourth Amendment rights. It goes to the effect on the individual interests. So I think it's highly relevant to this court's analysis of whether the Fourth Amendment is violated by this statute. I see I'm getting into my rebuttal time, so I'll reserve the remainder.
Okay. Excuse me.
I'm not sure I got an answer to my question about Kebedeau and conflicting social science information and the role that the courts should play versus the role that the legislature should play in that. Kebedeau seems to weigh against your position here.
I think that as the government policy at issue becomes more intrusive, more long-lasting, and more burdensome on the person that is subject to it, a stronger government justification and a stronger reliance on the evidence bearing on that justification is necessary.
I understand that position. What would you say is your best precedential support for that kind of sliding scale?
I think that it's reflected throughout the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. When you're looking at something like registration, that can be done categorically. However, as you move along the continuum towards more restrictive...
I understand your position. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Spicer, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'm Jody Schmelzer, an Assistant Attorney General for the state of Wisconsin, and I represent Jared Hoy, Wisconsin's Department of Corrections Secretary. The state of Wisconsin has determined that repeat sex offenders pose an intolerable risk to public safety, and more specifically, the health and well-being of our children, who are the most vulnerable members of our society. To address this risk, Wisconsin's law requires GPS monitoring of sex offenders who have been convicted on more than two or more occasions of qualifying sex offenses. Mr. Antrim and the class of plaintiffs bringing this action have done just that. He has sexually assaulted children on two or more occasions and has been convicted of these offenses. They are repeat sex offenders and subject to GPS monitoring under Wisconsin's law. This law does implicate the Fourth Amendment, but it does survive constitutional scrutiny under both a totality of the circumstances analysis and under the special needs doctrine.
Ms. Schmelzer, could you address this kind of information apparently being readily available as public records to anybody who might ask for them?
Right. I think it's a bit of a red herring in this case. There's absolutely no evidence that either Mr. Antrim or any member of the class have had this information disclosed as a result of a public records request.
Okay, but would you agree that the Department of Corrections treats these minute-to-minute raw data records as public records available upon request?
I would agree with that. Under Wisconsin law, they are considered public records, and under Wisconsin law, those records can be disclosed after a balancing test is applied, balancing the disclosure versus the private interest at stake. There was testimony in the case that those types of records have been disclosed pursuant to public records requests, but again, no evidence that it's ever been disclosed as far as a member of this class. And I would also note, I guess in reference to Your Honor's previous question, it's a balancing test. It as far as a remedy to prevent those types of disclosures, that's by department policy. It can certainly be changed.
Where does the balancing test come from?
It comes from Wisconsin law, from case law. Sorry, Your Honor.
Sorry. I've not encountered Wisconsin's open records law before. I'm sure at least one of my colleagues here has. What concerns me here is a Wilson versus Lane kind of problem, right? Wilson against Lane, as you may recall, was where where police took Washington Post reporters along to execute a search warrant. And the Supreme Court unanimously said that was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. And if I can think of a lot of different hypotheticals I won't inflict on everybody right now, but if the results of otherwise reasonable government searches are made public, that seems like a problem to me.
I don't think that would be a basis for invalidating this law, Your Honor. That certainly, like I said, is a matter of a balancing test, and at this point, department policy in determining where that balance should occur. If it's later determined that the privacy interests of these individuals should tip that balance a different way, that policy can be changed. Those records need not be disclosed to as a result of any public records request. So that is a sliding scale. It can be changed, it can be adjusted as far as how the department balances that scale and weighs those privacy interests.
Including never disclosing results from this system of monitoring.
They certainly do disclose them to law enforcement agencies.
Well, sure. Yeah, I totally get. That's not a public records disclosure. I'm talking about the media and bloggers and neighborhood watch groups and so on.
I think that's a determination that can be made. It may be played out in the Wisconsin courts at some point if such a disclosure were denied under our public records law. But I think that that's certainly a determination that the department can make given the balancing test that's applied to these types of requests, public records requests. Again, this court in Below v. Wall has already engaged in the balancing test applicable under the Fourth Amendment. It's found that GPS monitoring in Wisconsin under this law was reasonable. That analysis is just as applicable here. As this court acknowledged in its prior decision in Brown v. Carr, the differences between Mr. Below and Mr. Antrim and the class here were immaterial as far as the analysis went on a reasonable expectation of privacy. And this public records issue is the only difference that's been highlighted since that decision has come out. And I would submit that that is not determinative in this case as far as rebalancing and reassessing the decision in below. All the other expectations of privacy that Mr. Below, or diminished expectations of privacy that Mr. Below experienced, are the same for Mr. Antrim and the class. They are subject to the sex offender registry. It's publicly available, their picture, what crimes they've committed, their types of victims. I would also note that different than what was emphasized in Below is these are all special notification bulletin, special bulletin notification offenders. So even when they move to a different community or neighborhood, they're subject to notification and disbursement of that information to their neighbors. These are also individuals that are subject to Wisconsin's DNA evidence law, which
Could I ask you, do you think your reasoning here would allow the legislature to impose this requirement of GPS monitoring on other categories of convicted defendants, such as those convicted of sex crimes against adults, or maybe any violent crime, or maybe any felony?
There are other categories in Wisconsin's GPS monitoring law that apply, just as a different category applied to Mr. Below. There are categories that apply to offenders with just one serious sex offense in given categories of offenses, serious ones that involve physical or threat of force. And there's discretionary imposition of GPS monitoring for other types of offenders. So our law does take that into consideration, Your Honor.
And you think your reasoning would, if we agree with you, you think we would be effectively upholding all of the mandatory conditions?
I don't think this case encompasses those other provisions necessarily. Plaintiffs tried to certify a class that would, and Judge Ludwig found that they wouldn't properly represent those other offenders. So I don't think that a decision in this case would necessarily be preclusive as far as a challenge to other provisions of the GPS monitoring statute. I think it would be difficult given the decision in Below, the diminished expectation of privacy these types of offenders have, but I don't think it's preclusive, Your Honor, to answer your question.
The plaintiff's reply brief cited three cases, I believe for the first time, in addition to the Grady case out of the North Carolina Supreme Court, but cases out of South Carolina, Georgia, and Massachusetts that had all struck down what looked like pretty similar requirements. And I was wondering if you'd like to address any of those cases.
I would, Your Honor. First of all, in State v. Grady, the North Carolina case went to a great extent, in fact, dedicated a footnote to distinguishing Wisconsin's law that was at issue in Below and finding that North Carolina's law was different in material respects to the point where Below it acknowledged that fact and that the decision in Below was different because of the different facts and the categories of offenders that were subject to GPS monitoring in North Carolina. It also required things like equipment checks every 3 months, during which time the offender had to allow personnel or state officials in entrance into their home to conduct these. So I think in that respect, the Grady case is distinguishable. The other three cases are even more distinguishable, I think, than Grady. In Park v. State, the Georgia court found that because the location data was immediately reported to law enforcement, that this, in fact, was the primary purpose of their GPS monitoring law and therefore didn't qualify as a valid special needs search. And in State v. Ross, there was a somewhat unique circumstances at issue there. That offender had been convicted of only one prior misdemeanor sex offense some 36 years ago. And the reason why their statute imposed lifetime monitoring on him was because he had not abided by a technical requirement in their sex offender registry law. So after the fact, and some 29 years after he was released from prison, he was put on lifetime GPS monitoring. So those situations are obviously unique and different from Wisconsin's law. And lastly, in the Felice case out of Massachusetts, that court, citing below, distinguished its decision from cases interpreting the United States Constitution's Fourth Amendment right, because their case hinged on a provision in the Massachusetts statute that required individualized determinations of reasonableness in these kinds of searches. So I think all of those cases have some key distinctions, and even in two of them expressly distinguished below in Wisconsin's law as relevant to the outcome in those cases. I would also note that just as many cases have upheld lifetime GPS monitoring in other states, including in Missouri, Michigan, New Jersey, and Tennessee. And we know, too, that the individualized assessments, the reason why Mr. Antrim is arguing that these cases violate the Fourth Amendment, that why this provision does, is because it doesn't contain individualized assessments. We know that the Fourth Amendment doesn't require a finding of individualized suspicion. And in fact, the Supreme Court in Skinner expressly refused to require a lesser intrusive alternative requirement for these types of searches. It noted that such a requirement could raise insuperable barriers to the exercise of virtually all search and seizure powers, because judges, plaintiffs' experts, anyone can, in post hoc evaluations of government conduct, can almost always imagine some alternative means by which objectives of the government might have been accomplished. It does not violate the Fourth Amendment to cast an over-inclusive net with these types of administrative searches, as we know from several cases of the Supreme Court, including Sitz, including Von Raab, Skinner. All of these cases have fielded arguments that challenged those searches because they didn't contain individualized assessments, that they include individuals that may not necessarily specifically further the government interests, or may not further it as much as others. So we know that that doesn't make this statute unconstitutional, because it may include some individuals that don't pose as much of a danger after an individualized assessment as others in this class. I'd also like to address Judge Hamilton's comment on the Kubota case. It is for this type of legislation, especially cases that discuss sex offender recidivism rates or government interests that use sex offender recidivism as a legitimate government interest in supporting those laws. This isn't a new kind of issue or argument that's been made as far as being new social science or different or evolving or even contrary evidence in the case. And cases like Kubota reject that and say, we're not going to take over the role of the legislature. And it's not unreasonable because there's conflicting social science out there. This court relied on that in Brahm, and it should do so today as well. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meltzer. You have a little bit of time left.
Counsel pointed out that the North Carolina Supreme Court in Grady distinguished its statute from the statute at issue in Bolo, and that's true. The reason it distinguished it was because the statute at issue in Grady is identical to the one that we're challenging here. And the North Carolina Supreme Court found it was unconstitutional to subject individuals to lifetime GPS monitoring solely based on their status as recidivists. I think that the court is asking an important question of the state. Is there any limiting principle to the state's arguments? They haven't articulated one. They have made a very broad argument here in defense of their statute that substitutes labels for evidence. As long as they label someone as dangerous and an enduring risk, that's all that they're requiring. And the facts matter. And we brought forth evidence. There was expert testimony. The district court deemed all of it irrelevant. And that was an error that merits reversal. Counsel is correct that individualized suspicion and individualized consideration is not an irreducible requirement of the Fourth Amendment. But in some cases, it is necessary. And in the cases where the court has been willing to dispense with the requirement of individualized suspicion and individualized consideration, we've had short duration searches, oftentimes conducted when there is a pre-existing regulatory or supervisory relationship between the person being searched and the government. That's not what we have here. So as you move down that continuum towards a search that is longer in duration, more intrusive in its requirements, there is a stronger requirement for some modicum of individualized suspicion. So we're not here to tell you today that GPS monitoring can never be imposed on anyone, but that there is some requirement of individualized consideration before it can be imposed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel in the case. The court will take the case under advisement, and that concludes our afternoon arguments.